The following is a presentation of Open for Business, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship's conference for business students and business professionals at the Urbana 06 Missions Convention, held in St. Louis, December 2006. For more information, please visit ofb.intervarsity.org.
Tonight is John Beckett. John did his studies at MIT and worked as an engineer and in the aerospace industry. And later on, he worked in his father's manufacturing company and helped really build that into a worldwide company. He eventually became the president. And the company manufactures component parts for commercial residential heating. John and his wife, Wendy, have been married for 45 years. They have 6 children and 11 grandchildren. Just a piece of trivia, Wendy shared with me that she has been here at Urbana before, but hasn't been here recently. The last time she was at Urbana was 1957. She's a student at the University of Toronto, so we welcome her back, and we welcome John tonight. So, let's have a quick word of prayer, and then John will share. Lord, we thank you that you are a good and great God. You are the God of the universe, you're the God of our lives, and you're the God of corporations. And we desire to be transforming agents in the places that you place us to work. And thank you for the companies that we serve and we work in now, places that we will work in after we finish our studies. We thank you for John and his generosity in coming tonight to share his experiences and his wisdom of many years of being faithful and being a leader of a particular company, but also a leader in among North American Christian people. Thank you for this evening, and we look forward to the way that you will teach us and challenge us and how we can be more effective in applying advanced principles in the companies that we are in.
I'm just going to ask if Wendy would come up for a minute, and she can tell you what she remembers from being here in 1957.
Well, I remember a very long train ride all night long getting here. I remember it being a wonderful, life-changing experience and just expanding vision. Isn't it wonderful how it just expands our vision of what God's doing on the earth? It's a thrilling time to just come away and to experience the breadth of what God's doing. So that's what I remember the most. And I'm thrilled to be back here again, especially with my husband being here.
Well, we talk a lot about business partnerships, but I don't know if any is more important than the partnership between a husband and wife. And Wendy's been very much a part of my world. She actually, in a formal sense, she's part of our board of directors. So I suppose technically she can fire me. it might be hell to pay it. No, I mean, but we did that because I wanted Wendy to be intimately familiar with our company, its processes, our advisors, and that makes it much easier for us to communicate. Not that we talk a lot about business at home, but just to have that understanding. You got to be wiped out at the end of all of these sessions, and if we're only going to hold on to you for an hour here. If you can hang in for one more hour, then you'll all get a badge of merit. But this has been a real whirlwind session, and I appreciate your coming out tonight. I realize that Rick Warren is speaking over in the arena, and he has a huge amount to say Of course, you can just turn on television and hear him, but I think you're here because you have a keen interest in the whole area of businesses, missions, and I'm just so impressed that InterVarsity has had the foresight to add this in to an already very extensive program. As you know, it's the first time that they have done this. And I had lunch with Alec Hill today and had a chance to express to him personally that I really appreciate that and feel that it's very timely. My own involvement in business for pretty close to four decades has been as a Christian. And I'm going to tell some things about our story tonight. I find that that's one of the more compelling ways to communicate things that have been wrestled through, learned along the way. So even though I have a story to tell and a presentation, I want you to feel very free to pop in with questions along the way or clarifying anything that isn't clear. And I'd like to just begin with a little bit of a exercise. You would know the publisher, InterVarsity Press, of course, and they have published two books that I've written, Loving Monday and Mastering Monday, so I've gotten to know that organization well. And earlier this year, I was asked to meet with their entire staff of some 90 people at a retreat they had. And sometimes I get a little mischievous in these situations, and I said to all of the InterVarsity people, with Bob Freiling, their president, not looking at the rest of his staff, that I would like them to answer a question for me, pop quiz, and I'm going to ask you the same question. And that is InterVarsity Press a book publisher, a business, or a ministry, or some kind of hybrid between the two? And I'm just going to ask for a quick show of hands now, just, you know, whatever comes to your mind. But is InterVarsity a business? What would you think? Okay, a couple hands going up. Is it a ministry? Quite a few more hands. Is it some kind of something else? Is it a hybrid between the two? Okay. Let me tell you what their response was. It was almost exactly a third, a third, a third. And incidentally, I asked that same question the following day to almost 300 Christian business professors who were meeting as part of the Christian Business Faculty Association. And their answer was the same. It was about a third, a third, a third. And it's interesting to kind of play with that idea a little bit, because whenever we get into a dilemma, we go back to what we did in Sunday school class, and regardless of what the question was, what was the answer?
Jesus,
right? So the answer is Jesus. And so, well, let's just play with that for a little bit. We know Jesus, of course, as the rabbi, but we need to think from time to time about Jesus the carpenter. And Jesus was a carpenter for maybe four times as long as he was a rabbi and a minister. And when we think of him as being a carpenter, we think of the kinds of things that somebody in a small business would do. He had to buy materials, he had to manage employees, he had to sell, he had to meet a payroll, he had to satisfy customers, all the practical things that come out of a business environment. And yet it's not hard to imagine that being Jesus, he brought the concept of his Father's kingdom into every aspect of his work. So when he was working with employees, he was discipling them. When he was working with customers, he was sharing his Father's heart with him. When he was building a piece of furniture or working on a yoke, he was doing it with extraordinary excellence. And so it's not hard to imagine that he had practically brought these two worlds together. But what struck me one day when I was thinking about this is that as a rabbi, when he was in this three-year period that he's best known for, would he have not brought into that part of his life the skills, the capabilities that he developed as a business person? Even to the point of discipling 12, which would have been very parallel to the kind of apprenticing that he might have done in his own workshop, but bringing that combination of skills together. So I guess the point here is that maybe these lines of demarcation are not quite so clear-cut as we sometimes think. It's actually an absurdity to ask which Jesus was who when, because he was only one Jesus. And yet, stepping from one into the other may not have been quite so dramatically different as we might imagine. So it's just kind of interesting to think about that and take that back to whether the varsity press is a business or a ministry. I personally think that it really is a hybrid, which is how most of you were indicating as well, that there's this merging of faith and business practices into an enterprise that's making a difference. Well, I'd like to just tell a bit about our story, and I put a PowerPoint together to do this, and it's been a fascinating journey. Wendy's been an integral part of that journey for most of it, but not all of it, because part of it really started way back in the 30s. And I'm seated there on my parents' lap. I was the first child to live from my parents. My father was an engineer from the University of Toronto. Started his own business actually in the basement of the home that we were living in northern Ohio in 1937, which I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is the same year that InterVarsity got its start in the U.S. at the University of Michigan, right? Is that more or less correct? So just to orient the thing in time. My dad was very interested in finding ways to heat people's homes automatically. And at that time, the typical way in which people heated their homes was with coal. And there was a slogan in our industry that a coal shovel was never fit for a woman's hands. And oil actually became the first automatic form of heating. And he was an entrepreneur. He was a pioneer in that industry. And before long, we moved out of the basement of our home into a small rental factory where we functioned for the next 10 or 12 years. But remember 1937, 38, 39, what was happening. We were just coming out of the Great Depression, but what was looming in Europe. It was World War II, and this had a very real impact on virtually every business. And in our case, the advent of the war meant that critical materials that would have been used in producing our product were diverted to the war industry, copper, steel. And so what does the entrepreneur do? The last thing he does is to throw up his arms and say, well, the sledding is too tough. We just have to abandon our dream and go do something else. Well, my dad said, look, people are still living in homes. Energy is becoming more and more precious for the war effort. Let's insulate people's homes. And so he got a couple insulation trucks. He took all of the work crew that he had and put them into a totally different line of business for about 4 years. And we insulated hundreds and hundreds of homes in northern Ohio to keep people warm, keep our employees going, keep the business afloat. And then after the war, it was possible to go back to our basic business. But I love to think back to that story, because the number one challenge for any business is survival. And you do what you have to do to survive. So after the that's the insulation truck. I meant to bring that up earlier. But after the war and the lapse of some years, we were able to actually build our first factory, a plant facility that we're still in today, expanded many times. But that was a dream to get into our own business. Now, while this was going on in the company, I was going through high school. And toward the end of high school, I had the first real crisis concerning vocation. And that crisis was whether, as I thought about college, I would go into a college that had some kind of opportunity for spiritual pursuits, or whether I would go into engineering, which was where my heart was. And I applied to colleges that could open up either avenue. And when I was accepted by a liberal arts school that had an adjunct seminary to it, I was pleased, but I wasn't overjoyed. It was a month, 6 weeks later, that a letter came in the mail from MIT accepting me into an engineering program. And I'll tell you, something just leapt in my heart. Even though I wondered what it all meant, because could I have some kind of Christian service in engineering? I didn't know, but that's certainly where my heart was. And so off I went to Boston. And 1 year into college, I had an amazing experience. I was at a cottage that our family had about 200 miles north of Toronto in Algonquin Park. And I went into this little store that sold supplies for cottagers and for campers. And a young lady waited on me that just took my breath away. And you may have guessed it, that happened to be Wendy. And so she was trying to earn some money to get through college. She was going to begin at the University of Toronto the next fall. And I fell head over heels in love with Wendy. Now, where was I spiritually at this point? I had been going to a denominational church. I, to the best of my knowledge, had never really entered into a vital relationship with Christ, but I was still trying to do what I thought would be pleasing to God. When I met Wendy and her family, that all started to change, because for the first time in my life, I was encountering what I now refer to as authentic Christianity. They loved the Lord, and it showed. And the first I became aware of this was when I went to visit Wendy, and at her cottage. Her parents had a cottage up there too, and she was out on the dock. And as I drew up to the dock in the boat, I realized, number one, she was in her bathing suit. This looked a whole lot better than serving, you know, soup and toilet paper over at the Portage store. But the other thing that was interesting was that she had this big book that she was reading from with gold edges on it. And I remember my thought. I said, nobody reads the Bible on vacation. And so here I was faced with this dilemma. And yet, as I got to know Wendy and her family, I just discovered that this was a different breed of Christianity than I had ever encountered before. And it created a thirst. It created a hunger in me. So it was 4 years later. Wendy graduated from college, and just a few months after that, we were married. And we moved to Ohio, and we soon began our family. Now, by this point, I had finished my undergraduate work, and I had dilemma number two concerning the whole issue of direction in my life. And I wrestled with the same question that I had as a high school student. It took a little bit different form because I thought, if I'm really going to do something that will serve the Lord, I could go into the chaplaincy in the military for a while and have a form of Christian service that way. And I went to visit the rector or the pastor of a large Episcopal church that I was attending in Boston, and put my dilemma before him, and his answer was really clear, and we're having a lot of discussion about call in this conference. And he said to me, "John, if you are being called to the ministry, you will know it without doubt. And until you get some kind of a call of that nature, I wouldn't recommend that you go in that direction." Well, I felt, frankly, a kind of relief. And the next day, I got a job offer from Boeing to join them in Seattle in aircraft design. I didn't go with Boeing. I went with another aerospace firm, Lear. And for the next several years, I worked as an engineer designing guidance systems for missiles and for aircraft. Well, the fellow that you see up there, my dad, now older and wiser than in the last picture that you saw him, one day after dinner, Wendy and I were having dinner at his home, just ask almost as casually as you'd ask about the weather, "John," he said, "my business partner is going to retire. How would you like to come to work for me?" And I remember my answer. I said, "You know, I really have never thought about that before. It sounds awfully good to me. When can we get started?" And so, without a lot of premeditation, I left the one world of combustion putting spacecraft in orbit to this very small business, 12 employees, about $1 million of sales, making combustion equipment, but for heating people's homes. And that was, in my opinion, going to be a decade and a half long process of working with my dad, him the mentor, me the understudy, and we had a wonderful time working together. Really, it was very different than our relationship as father and son earlier. We were in business together, and it was a really very special time. But it ended much more abruptly than I ever imagined. I got a call on a chilly February morning that my dad was found slumped over the steering wheel of his car driving to work. And it radically impacted my world. He was 67 at the time, and I was 26. And I was just immediately faced with the question of what this meant for the business. We had people who called and offered to buy it. What about my mother? Her livelihood was tied up in the company. Would it be a better thing for her if I sold it? But I had a sense that this company had a destiny to it and that I was called. Now, that's the first time I've used this term in regard to my business experience, but I sensed that there was a kind of call to build and sustain this company. So began that process and just started getting things stabilized, and another call came. This one was in the middle of the night from our fire department. saying, Beckett, the flames are leaping 20 feet out the roof of your company. You better get out here. And I thought I was having a bad dream, literally. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. Realized it wasn't. Got out. We fought that fire all night. And somehow, by the grace of God, the entire plant did not burn down. It was very severely damaged. And we mobilized our workforce, which was now maybe up to 14 or 15 people. We worked around the clock. And we somehow did not miss a single shipment to our customers during that period. And that involved rebuilding machinery and rewiring. And it was unbelievable. But these two events occurring in close succession to each other had the effect of bringing me to the end of myself. And sometimes that can be a good thing. And I don't know whether any of you are in engineering programs at all, or whether you're engineers, or some of you. Well, maybe you can identify a little bit with this graphic, because it's probably the most helpful way I've found to describe what was going on. And you know the process by which a piece of metal is stress tested. It's put under pressure and you compare stress or force on one axis with movement on the other axis. And metal has a certain behavior characteristic to it. You can put a lot of force on it, you see very little movement. And then all of a sudden, a little bit more force, and you get to what's called the yield point, and that metal gives way and yields. And I think this is what happened to me as I look back on it. There were these forces that were bringing me to the end of myself, and I got to the point where I just yielded my life to Jesus Christ. Now, mind you, I had had a church upbringing. I had had the example of Wendy and her family. But we engineers can leave very long heel marks across the the stage of life. And it frankly took these things, I believe, for me to come to the end of myself. Well, I became a follower of Jesus Christ. It radically changed my world, but it also created a dilemma for me, because I had no models for anybody who is a believer functioning in the business world. Anybody I knew was involved in some kind of church work. And so the dilemma for me, and you can kind of see parallels with what had happened in high school and then in college, can I really serve the Lord in the workplace? And I wrestled with this. There wasn't a quick answer, like a letter coming from MIT or a word of wisdom from a church pastor. But at a certain point, I sensed God was speaking to me. Not audibly, but what he said, I felt in my spirit, was, John, I have called you into the workplace. Do that with all your heart. And so I wanted to tell enough of that story to encourage you, and the theme of this conference is calling and walking faithfully in that calling. I wanted to say that in my own case, it really became clear that there was such a thing as a call to business. And when I accepted that, my response was, I will do this, and I will do it with all my heart. And this was in the late 1960s. And the story I have to tell, really, since then, is that in spite of lots of challenges, which I won't take time to enumerate on, we saw God's faithfulness in taking a business that was embryonic and putting it on a growth trajectory that has been breathtaking. We remained private. We have stayed non-union in what are now multiple companies. Our employment is now some 650 people, our $1 million of sales are now $120 million of sales, and lots of challenges along the way, but we have seen God take us through a remarkable period of growth and the capacity to influence around us. Well, I'm just going to give you a couple markers along the way, and you had set out on the chairs this thing that we call a corporate roadmap. And I want to commend this to you because a lot of thought and care has gone into its development. Every organization, if it's worth its salt, has tried to address questions of vision and values. But I would just suggest that whatever business activity you're in, this needs to be thought through very carefully from a kingdom perspective. And ours is just one example, but you'll see in there language that is intended to bolt together these two worlds of work and faith in a way that we can communicate very transparently with our employees, customers, other people in the community, because we want to visibly be a Christian-based, biblically focused organization that is pursuing excellence and integrity and profoundly respecting individuals in all that we do. So we have a vision to build a family of companies, each of which is distinctive in serving its customers in important ways and which has the practical application of biblical values throughout. And we really mean this. This is something that we're being put to the test to all the time. Are we walking the talk? Are we really living out the things that we say are most important to us? And then the values that I just referred to are so key to us. And you can see in each one of these basic values that they trace right back to biblical roots. And so when we talk with our employees about the importance of integrity, we talk with them about the root of that concept and say integrity or wholeness comes about because this is a biblical idea that is non-negotiable. Excellence is a biblical concept modeled by Jesus as much as anybody else that needs to be right at the heart of who we are as an organization. And we uncompromisingly must have a profound respect for one another, regardless of work position or whatever. I can tell you that today is a sad day for me because just before I came over here, I got word that an employee who we have valued for 15 years fell into a pattern of embezzlement using a credit card over the last month or 6 weeks. And I've just had a very warm relationship with this employee. And one of the things that I think about when I think of him is that he actually came to us some years back and challenged us on one of our core values. And it went something like this. He said, Mr. Beckett, there was a job that was open for promotion in the company. I applied for it. I didn't get it. That isn't what bothered me. The person who got the job, I think, is well qualified. But what did bother me is that I found out about it, not from the company, but from a number of employees who called me at home at night. I think you have violated the whole concept of the profound respect for the individual that you hold important. Now, this is a plant floor employee who's coming in and talking to the president of the company. And I said, you've really got my attention. I dug into it, and I found that there was an extenuating circumstance, not that we did the right thing. The extenuating circumstance was that he had been out for surgery, and our people had actually discussed whether they would call him at home to tell him that he didn't get the job or wait until he got back. And they chose the latter course. Of course, he found out about it almost immediately from other employees. And yet the thing that encouraged me was that he had the gumption, really, to come in and talk about the violation of one of our core values. Now, the sadness to me is that we promoted him just recently. We gave him a corporate credit card. And by golly, if he didn't take that thing out to an ATM and start pulling down thousands of dollars into his own pocket. So while he's challenging me on respecting, you know, we've got the dilemma now that he has absolutely violated number one core value in the company, and we've got to walk that out. We have to face up to it. So these are the realities of business. When you get close to people, as we try to do, you sometimes get caught in these real difficult situations. We're now a family of companies. Our focus is still on combustion and in the heating area. And what we've tried to do as we have built multiple companies is retain a continuity of the culture through these organizations, so that if you go into any of them, you're going to kind of sense the same type of commitment to these values. I just want to fast forward to something that I suppose is the reason that I'm here tonight. Our efforts to bring faith and work together came to the attention of ABC News just over a decade ago. And Peter Jennings had hired a reporter by the name of Peggy Wehmeyer to do stories on that had spiritual content to them. And Peggy became aware of what we were doing and proposed that we would be the subject for a story that would air on national news. We were very reluctant to do that, I can tell you, because I'd had some bad experiences with the media. But for various reasons, we felt we should do this. This was the introduction, the text there is the introduction to a four-minute news piece that aired in September of 95. Peter Jennings actually wrote that himself. And it was one of the early indicators that the national media was taking note of what was happening, this merging of faith and work. And so that news piece aired. After it did, I got a report that there were more people who called into the national news network in New York with positive comments than anything they had ever run on the evening news. And that really got my attention. And that's when I got to work right out of my comfort zone and began writing my first book, which was published a couple years later, called Loving Monday. Now, that title strikes people as either appropriate or amusing. We normally think in terms of Loving Friday. So just because there is some controversy connected with that, I'd like to add to that controversy with a little video clip here. This is the traditional view. Son-in-law is an attorney with the National Science Foundation, and that was actually footage that they took in Antarctica. So the labels were not original, but just updating. Kevin is our oldest son. He's now become the CEO of our company. We've actually transitioned the company to the third generation, which is kind of neat because that doesn't happen very often. He's really right for the job, and he's a great leader, and it's giving me a bit more time to do the kind of thing that I'm doing now. In addition to that, I wrote a second book that was published that came out earlier this year, and this is really geared at trying to provide as broadly as I knew how the biblical foundation for this whole concept of bringing faith and work together. So I tell about companions on the journey, people like Daniel and Nehemiah and Moses and Boaz and others who really were in a workplace context and came out of that to fulfill God's plan in their lives. You know, I think I'm going to just stop there for the moment, and I'm going to go back a little bit. Can we go back? I'm just struck with how significant this whole process of bringing faith and work together is. And I mentioned ABC picking up on this. This was a few years later, and it's really ironic to me that Fortune magazine, on its cover story in 2001, had the story about God and business. And it was just a few months after that that Enron hit the skids. And so it's almost like we see these two forces at work. The effort to bring faith into the workplace on the one hand, but greed and corruption in American business on a scale of which we've just never seen before in our history. So this is the dilemma that we face today, and I think that we have a tremendous opportunity as believers to function in whatever aspect of the workplace that we're called to and really make a difference. But let's just open it up. I want to know what you're thinking, and maybe as you comment, you could just, first of all, give your name if you would, and then just say what you're doing at this point in your life or where you're from, just so that we can get a little bit of relationship going with each other here. We're going to have a roving microphone here.
Robert Merkel, Rapid City, South Dakota, National University. I'm a Management Information Systems major. In the stories of the Bible, the single major character that has had success, in the end failed in some way, do you think that the same forces that caused them to fail in the end caused your employee that charged up his credit card caused him to fail?
And can I come back to you with a question, and that is, what would you say was the common root of failure among the Bible people that you're referring to?
The love of money.
Yeah. Whether that was the case with our employee or not, we have to learn more about. I can tell you that there's something that emerged in his work history with us that probably wasn't true with biblical characters, and that was a problem with drugs. And whether it was the love of money or whether it was some compulsion that he hadn't really come to grips with, that's going to have to come out as we investigate this. But there's a deeper principle in what you're saying. Let's just take some people, for example. Solomon, one of the greatest leaders and enormously blessed by God. In his case, he let down his guard on something God was very specific about, and that was bringing in foreign wives. Because with the foreign wives came the foreign gods, and so ultimately he let idolatry into the camp. David, referred to as the greatest king Israel ever had, worked through it to a degree, but the fatal flaw with David was lost. And what preceded that was a dereliction of duty. Recall, he stayed back rather than going out with the army. And that's when he saw Bathsheba, fell into sin, and then tried to cover that whole thing by having her husband killed. And, you know, the interesting thing about that story is that this man, as great as he was blinded to the sin that he was involved in until the prophet came to him, was it Nathan? And told him the story. David was outraged, and then Nathan said, "You're the man." And fortunately, David had so much of a heart for God that he broke before that. But look at the consequences of it. You know, losing the child, alienation from his family for the rest of his reign. And your point is really a good one. And I think that my takeaway from the lessons of these great leaders and what I see happening around me contemporaneously is how critical it is that we walk carefully. There's a passage in Genesis where God addresses Cain and Abel, and his comment is, "Sin is crouching at the door, but you must master it." And so that, I think, puts the responsibility back on us to learn how to walk in such a way that we are not consumed and overwhelmed with sin. We will sin. And as we know, God provides the way back, as he did with David. But the consequences lingered forever. In the corporate, in the modern corporate setting, we're seeing it play out. I guess the last of the Enron trials just happened. But look at the sentences that these titans of industry were getting. I mean, Jeff Skilling, McKinsey consultant, Harvard MBA, one of the brightest guys in the business world, and yet he was just sentenced weeks ago to how many years was it in prison? Much of the rest of his life he'll spend in prison. So, it's a great question.
Adam Appelter, I'm a senior at I'm a senior at Michigan State University. I'm a supply chain management major, and I'm just curious, what would be if you had to give anybody advice, what's the most practical way of integrating your faith and work, how would you respond?
Jan Carlson, who was the president of SAS Airlines, had a great expression. He talked about moments of truth. And I think that what happens in our day-to-day activities is that we have these moments of truth where we often, with very short time to think about it, have to make decisions. And it's these decisions at the margin, it's these little decisions that we have to make on the spot that either indicate that we are serious about our faith and bringing them together, or we're discounting that kind of internal gyroscope that is intended to keep us on course. We were talking with a woman at the conference here. Her husband is a computer programmer, and he works for a major medical facility in northern Ohio. And a recruiter was trying to lure him into another job. And the recruiter, looking over his resume, said, "If you will adjust what you say your work experience was over here, you're going to be a much more acceptable candidate to the person I'm trying to recruit you into, the company I'm trying to recruit you into. And, you know, he had to make a decision right on the spot there. Am I going to compromise my integrity by a slight shading of my experience in order to pick up this job? Or am I going to say, this is who I am, this is what my experience is, and let the chips fall where they will? So, you know, yeah, there are the big things. If you were on the Enron board, and if you look at the makeup of the people who are on that board, there was a moment of truth, which really was a tipping point. And the moment of truth was when Andy Fastow came to the board and proposed these arrangements, these financial arrangements that were outside the normal course of business. And to approve those arrangements, this prestigious board of directors had to consciously set aside the conflict of interest rules for Enron. Now, is anybody here from Stanford? The dean of the business school of Stanford was one of those board members, just to give you an idea of the caliber. But that moment of truth, they said, sounds like a good deal to us. They set aside the conflict of interest rules, did the deal. And I have to believe, now it wasn't the only thing going on at Enron, but I have to believe that the board at that point in time determined the destiny of that organization. So, I don't know if that's helpful, but that's...
So it would be primarily just through having a transformed mind and sticking to your values and
yes.
Allowing those to dictate your decisions that you make?
That's the way I see it. And I learned this from Oz Guinness, by the way, but he had the expression that the early settlers in America said it was as though they had swallowed gyroscopes. And I love that imagery because these are values that went down deep enough so that when they came to these critical decisions, they didn't have to think a lot about it. They just did the right thing. Great college, by the way.
What's that?
A great college.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to correct something that was said in the talk this afternoon about all great leaders who failed in the Bible, because Daniel did not and Joseph did not. And I think we can also learn something by studying good cases as opposed to always studying cases of failure. And it seems to me the way you presented to us tonight is a good case, and learning from what you have said is really going to be perhaps as helpful or more helpful.
Thanks for your comment, and I appreciate the adjustment that you've made there, and I would concur with it. Now, we don't know all about the lives of these people, but one of my favorite characters is quite obscure in the Bible. His name is Boaz. And you know the story? He was. It's in the book of Ruth. And we meet Boaz as a wealthy landowner and a very well-regarded person in his community. What I gleaned from the story about him as I read it a while back was the interaction that he had with his employees. They were workers out in the field, and he's walking out in the field, and he greets them. And listen to the greeting. He says, "The Lord be with you." And their immediate response back, "The Lord be with you too." And what that said to me in terms of the rapport that they had between employer and employee. And of course, we know the rest of the story with Boaz, that he married Ruth, and what was the great-grandfather of David. The Bible does portray people who have walked and lived righteously, and we can learn from their example. Thank you.
I was wondering if you could share with us an example or two of times when standard North American manufacturing practices that were very acceptable conflicted with your faith, and how you worked through that. in your company?
We were doing business in Japan, and it was an important sector of our business. Out of the blue, we were asked by our Japanese associate for something that they called a commission. It was a polite word for a bribe. And one of the first questions, I'm sorry, your name was?
Marie.
Marie, one of the first questions that we had to think through was, do we operate by our standards or theirs? Because we recognized that they didn't necessarily conform in all degrees to ours. And I actually checked that with legal counsel because I was new to this kind of pressure. And I was assured that we are totally entitled to operate under not only the laws, but also the ethical standards of our company. And so we went back really in a very direct way to say that we were sorry that we could not meet their requirements. And I thought we'd probably lose the business. There was a price tag associated with that decision. Doesn't always work this way, but their response was, well, that's fine. We just thought we'd ask. and I'll guarantee it doesn't always work that way, but that's just one example that comes to mind. But they happen.
Hi, ma'am. I am a seasoned professional, a working professional. I work in the asset management area, but I had a question. I noticed that you operate a private company and also is a director on a public company. So I had two questions. One was, do you find it easier to apply Christ-centered principles at a public company or a private company? And the second question is, after Enron, I was curious if you had suggested to your board, or perhaps they had gone to you, to ask questions about Christ-centered principles.
I believe that walking out the things that we've found are important are definitely easier and more possible in a private setting. The added, now there are people who are doing what I'm doing in a public setting. I'll tell you about some of them in just a minute if you'd like. But you have a whole other set of accountability in shareholders, market analysts, and they don't understand this stuff. And if the earnings are great and everything else is wonderful, then maybe they don't care about it. When things turn a bit and they see that maybe you're not making that tough decision, you know, laying off people or doing something with your pricing or whatever, that will affect the earnings in the short run, they can be very tough on you. The great advantage in the private sector is that you can take a long-range approach. And we're in one of those valleys right now, frankly, in our business. Our business is slower now than I've seen it in 20 years. And we're facing a very practical dilemma because we have probably at least 25 more employees than we can really provide work for, and we're trying to wrestle that through. In fact, our son, who's the CEO, called one of our competitors the other day and asked whether they would like to have us make their product for them, and we're calling other companies in our area to see whether we can subcontract labor to them, because we're really trying to avoid laying people off if we can do that. So, you have much more flexibility in the private situation. As to the other question, we discussed Enron quite a bit at our in our company and some at our board level, because I think we really need to try to learn lessons from others. I read Power Failure this summer, which was a book that was co-authored by Sharon Watkins. Sharon Watkins was a person within Enron who tried to blow the whistle. In fact, she was named as one of Time's Persons of the Year for trying to bring attention to what was happening. And one of the takeaways I have from her efforts that went unheeded is that we've got to be very careful to listen to the voices of people who may be raising issues within our company and not be so arrogant that we don't hear those still small voices, the voices of, call them little people, nobody's little, but the people that we often take for granted who may have some kernel of truth that we really need to listen to. So, and we try to listen carefully and also promote that idea through all of our leadership. We've got to be very careful at listening.
Michael Redimer, entrepreneurs, small business. Question in terms of accountability, systems or processes in place that might be different than you see in a normal company that you use to kind of help, as you said, make sure you're listening to those small voices and not get too, you know, not getting things filtered, being the head of the company. Sometimes people don't like to give you bad news. Can you talk a little bit about how you manage some of those types of issues?
I think a lot of it has to do with the kind of culture that you set. And if an organization has a culture of fear or intimidation or intense internal competition, you're not going to surface that kind of vulnerability and honesty. If people do step forward and, first of all, don't get their heads chopped off, but in fact are respected for being willing to step out and say something, that encourages other people to do it. And so we'll never know the things that we're not hearing, but what we can do is really try to applaud the people who do take those risks. Where does accountability fall into that? I think if I had to say what is the single greatest pitfall of business leaders, at least in my observation, it's arrogance. Pride, arrogance, I think they're much the same thing. And so here we are today, in spite of our current doldrums, we have between 75 and 80% of the market share in all of the business sectors that we're in. And it would be so easy for a salesperson or for me or for anybody to come across as being superior in some way. And so a drum that we beat internally is that we do not want to see even a hint of arrogance in the way that we deal with customers, we deal with problems, we deal with other people. And the converse of that is that I have seen other people in our industry who have become arrogant and how it has cost them so enormously in their business relationships. It's really a lesson that we see modeled in Jesus. Came to serve and not be served. The Bible is replete with the importance of humility. Incidentally, in Collins' book, Good to Great, when he was looking at the qualities of great leaders, I don't know if any of you picked that up, but one of the recurring qualities that he saw in great leaders, as they were described by some of their peers, is that they were self-effacing, humble, gentle. Just about the opposite of the images that are often associated with business leaders. But the really successful ones, the ones that went from good to great, consistently had those qualities.
My name is Morella. I'm a junior international business
student in Oklahoma, and my question is, how do you measure the, in numbers actually, the effect that you as an individual and also your company is having in people's lives when it comes to, let's say, their faith and maybe even the spiritual goal that your company might have if that sentence might apply to it?
It's a great question, and I think it's very difficult to apply the kind of normal metrics to that question that we do to other things. That really is why we tend to default to the financial measures in running a business. In the long run, they may be the least important compared to the impact on other people's lives. And so what I actually look toward are the anecdotal incidents, some of which I'll be aware of and some of which I won't. I'll give you an example that happened fairly recently. I don't know, I don't want to press people's time, it's after 10. This story will take a couple minutes to tell, but it is so precious to me that if you'll allow me. Our plant superintendent came to me, and normally he's upbeat. On this particular occasion, he was downcast, and I said, "Vic, what is the problem?" And he said, "I just spoke with one of our young female employees who I can't name. I said I would honor her request for anonymity. But he said she asked for time off on a particular day. And he said I actually granted that to her without any particular discussion. But then she lingered in my office. And as she lingered, she said, "Now, the reason that I need this day off is to have an abortion." And Vic was kind of set back in his chair, and so we have a strong culture of life in our organization. And he said, I'll use the name Megan. "Megan, you know that the company will do everything that it can to help you if you have that child." And he cited some of the practical ways in which we would be able to help her. Well, he said, her mind is made up. She left my office, and I just come to you with the dilemma. I don't know what we can do. Well, Vic and I prayed about it there in the office, and I didn't know what we could do. Obviously, the person has the freedom to make that decision. But as Wendy and I talked about it that evening and again prayed about it, we just felt, Lord, could there be a way through this dilemma? And now it gets really interesting, because in the middle of the night I woke up. And when I woke up, the face of this person — we have over 600 employees, probably two-thirds of them women — the face of this employee was right in front of me, and I knew her name. And I thought, this is really an amazing thing. It had to be tested, but my impression was that the Lord was looking after her and cared for her. So I went into work the next morning, sought out Vic, and I said, "Vic, I realize you can't tell me the name of this employee, but if I tell you who it is, can you confirm it?" He said, "Well, I guess I can." And I said, "Well, it's Megan, isn't it?" And he was shocked. He hadn't told anybody else. And so I told him what happened. And he said, "Well, what should we do?" And I said, "We've got to call her in." And she came into my office. I first reassured her that Vic had not broken confidence, but I told her what had happened. And then I asked her, what do you think this means, Megan? And she said, I think God must be trying to tell me something. And I said, that's the way I see it too, and I just want to affirm what Vic has already told you, our willingness to help you through this situation. And I saw something that, I guess it shouldn't have been a surprise to me, but I saw somebody who had steeled themselves against what they knew to be right and was determined to go ahead with it anyway. And when she walked out of my office, I had no assurance that she would change her decision. And it was really a question of whether she would come to work the next day or not. So, of course, that was my first question when I came in. Is Megan here? And I was told that she was. She had not kept her day off. Well, we went through the day, and toward the end of the day, had her back into my office. And this was the most extraordinary thing, because Vic and I were in my office. She walked in through the door, and her smile was from ear to ear. Tears started down her face, and she just lifted her hands and said, I've decided to keep my baby. So she came in, and we talked about it. And at a point, I just said, Megan, God's been awfully good to you to walk through this whole scenario. He knows you. He cares for you. And he is interested in your decision here. Would you want to know him personally? And she said, I really would. And so right there in the office, she prayed to receive Christ. And I just thought, you know, would she have gone to a pastor? Would she have gone to a counselor? Would she have sought out professional help? And yet, right there in the workplace, her baby's life was saved, and spiritually she was saved too. And so how do you put a metric on that, you know? But to me, well, it sure made my day and my week and my probably my year, because it was just one of those glorious things. And we've seen many other things happen that are thrilling. Now, I don't want to totally set aside your question, because there's an organization. Who's from Michigan, University of Michigan?
Michigan State.
It's Michigan State. Anybody from U of M? U of M has a study underway in which they are trying to get a correlation between market metrics and a values-based approach. And I've looked at data now that goes back over 10 years, and they actually have found a pretty strong correlation. It's interesting that data can be available. If you want to dig deeper, you can ask me, but I really think it makes a difference. Strong set of values is ultimately going to show up in business metrics. And they're looking at EBITDA and customer retention and employee turnover and things that can be measured. It's a great question, though. Thank you.
You were close to the
Yes, I would be very glad to do both. Can I just say one more word about the second document that was set out on the chair? It's a little booklet called Coming Home. And I wrote this, I began writing it after the Columbia Space Shuttle broke up a few years ago. And I was just gripped by the question, did those astronauts know the Lord? Again, it was an instant in which they were facing eternity. And the gist of this little booklet, it's got a little bit about my story on it, just to kind of connect with the business and professional reader. But then the balance of it is a sensitive presentation of the gospel. Now, the update I want to give you since this was written is that in February of this year, this story was slightly reformatted and put up on a website. If you want to write this down, you can. It's called lifesgreatestquestion.com. And the most amazing thing is happening on this website. Not only did we kind of break the message down into smaller segments, but we gave people an opportunity that they could accept Christ on the internet and we can communicate with them. And what I want to tell you is this, that for the last 3 months, and this is data that we really can track, between 18 and 20,000 people have been visiting this website every month, and they're coming from all over the world. And of those, over 2,000 each month are indicating decisions for Christ. It's running right around 12.5%. So 1 out of 8 is indicating a decision for Christ on the internet. I mention this to you because you're networking with people who are hungry on your university campuses and elsewhere. And if this is a tool that you can use in any way to extend your faith, it's just extremely powerful. It's really new. This has just been happening within the last year, year and a half, by anybody. And yet, it may be the most powerful means of evangelism that that we have available today worldwide. We estimate, just through a number of websites that I'm familiar with, that there would be as many as 1 million people indicate decisions for Christ this coming year on the internet. And we think that that is totally scalable upward. The number one question that people are using to search with is meaning of life. And so if I can connect that back in with business's mission in a North American company, one of the real things I'm really grateful for right now is that out of a small, medium-sized manufacturing company in Northern Ohio, we have the opportunity to reach people all over the world with the gospel in business and professional situations. And if that ain't missions, you know, I don't know what it is, but it's coming right out of a business environment. Well, let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for the privilege that we've had of being here during this time, and it's coming to a close. And yet, we've been really conscious, Wendy and I and others, during this time that there are so many people who are in a valley of decision here, wanting to know your will for where to go next, how to take what you've placed in their heart to be relevant and to make a difference in life and to reach other people. And now, maybe for the first time at InterVarsity anyway, to be able to think about this within a business context. And we're just really encouraged by that, Lord. And I would just pray for each one who's here tonight that they would not go home without having a really strong sense of what you have said to them concerning their next steps as they walk out your purposes for them in the work world. Bless each one, I pray, Father, and would you bless all those who are here, all 20,000 people who are seeking to go on with you. We commend the evening to you, the large gathering in the arena, and every aspect of the remaining events. In Jesus' precious name.